Thanks a lot. Sorry for making you wait. So I want to talk about colloidal gels, and I will try to say basically three things. One is something a bit more general about colloidal gels, and in particular for the model that we use, and then how we try to understand dynamical processes that can be important in these systems, and how we have studied how deformation and yielding can take place. Okay, so before starting this, I will try to stay on time, so I should have 10 minutes for each of these things, let's see. but okay, before starting, I wanted actually to say something a bit general, just to put what I'm going to tell you next in the context, in some context, so also that you're not too deceived, because I'm not going to show any avalanche, I'm afraid. Okay, so this is, can you see if I write on the board?
No.
Thanks a lot. So the system that I'm, the materials I'm interested in and to that I have in mind are basically solids that form in suspensions of colloidal particles that are sticky. Okay, so there are attractive interactions. And so if we think in terms of the control parameters that I use in the experiments, which are basically the solid volume fraction, so the amount of particle in the suspension, and the strength of the attraction. So what one should think about is that, so this is KBT over U, where U is the strength of the attraction, and this is the volume fraction. So maybe probably what we've been thinking most of the time until now in this program is the systems that are here, right? In the sense that I have a relatively high volume fraction, let's say between 50, 60, 70%, and so on, where the structure of the material is solid, and it's mainly solid because of the static repulsion, and it's fairly homogeneous in the structure, okay? Then another situation to which one can think very, I think very easily, is the situation in which the particles are relatively, not necessarily very dense, and they just diffuse and stick together very strongly and irreversibly. And so in this case, one typically has aggregation processes that are of the type DLA, DLCA, and you form very fractal thin structures. So this is more or less down here. In principle, you can form a solid with any time an amount of solid material small at pleasure. Okay? And so this is would be, so let's say this is more glasses or jammed stuff, as we have heard about them until now. And this is more really kind of fractal gels that have been studied a lot in the 80s and 90s and so on. Mm-hmm. And now the material to which I'm thinking are kind of here, okay? So what it means is that basically this KBT over U is small enough that aggregation is important, but KBT is still relatively important, and some, because the particles are small, for example, or because this U is not necessarily enormous, and so which means that the aggregation is taking place, and eventually the material gets stuck into an amorphous state in which it's mechanically stable, but the driving for the aggregation is still the underlying thermodynamics, what is happening in this region. And so the structure that forms is actually affected by the underlying thermodynamics. So for example, typical cases are gel networks that form because there is a phase separation. So you can imagine that with an attractive interaction, basically you will have a gas-liquid phase separation in the solution. And so you will have a phase separation that is starting in the material, and this trigger or spinodal decomposition, and this trigger the formation of large domains, and then eventually the domains are ramified and the system gets to a state in which it's mechanically stable, and that's the gel. Okay, so a lot of the work that has been done in terms of theory and especially simulation has been done by looking at the formation, a disaggregation process and the formation of the gel. And I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm just interested in the dynamics and the mechanics of the gel once that it's formed. And I think that most of the work that probably one thing to think about is that most of the work that has been done in this region looking at disaggregation process and how the gel forms has been done with the idea that this is some kind of glass transition coming from the liquid side. Okay, and probably the idea that there is this dynamical arrest happens with the constraint of the mechanical stability taking place has not been really, I think, appreciated enough and used enough as a concept to understand what's going on. So I think this is instead probably something that we could that the people working on granular system, for example, could have some ideas on how to bring this in, or on jump systems. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to say about this stuff is that this is the solid I am talking about. Okay, one thing that is interesting is that in fact, in most of the materials that are important, that are interesting for engineering application or practical application, or from food science to biomedical application, any situation in which you are interested to use a material that is going from liquid to solid, in fact, it's in this region, right? In the sense that this is the situation that it's in fact embraces most of the practically relevant materials. And the other thing is that, in fact, in this region, for the reason I was saying before, that both thermodynamics and mechanical stability are important, what happens is that you have a strong heterogeneity of the structure that you can obtain. So the processing conditions are important, the quenching conditions, it's not only changing the strength of the attraction, but also shearing the material. And because you form a solid, that it's a relatively low volume fraction, and it can go to very low volume fraction, of course you need to have an heterogeneous structure to support that. So you have strong heterogeneities in the structure, but also in the mechanics. So when you start to deform the system, you can see very interesting rheological behaviors. For example, you can see that the material can yield. So the networks are physical in nature. So if you shear it, if you start to deform the material, parts of the structure can be broken, but parts of the structure can be also be brought together. And so the rheology and the mechanics that results of this can be quite complicated. And so you, if for example, there are experiments in which people detect things like double yielding process. So if you look at, this is usually the stress divided by the strain as a function of the strain. And then you see that you have a first yielding process and then a second yielding process. And the yielding, it's in many cases associated to the to flow instabilities in the material. So there are a number of, there is a variety of experiments, a number of very interesting experiments, especially some of which I'm going to mention. That, for example, just to mention a few, there is the experiment of Sébastien Mandille, Thibaut Divot in France. There is the group of Montpellier that has been working a lot on the dynamics of the gel networks, but also many other people. A very interesting experimental system is the one of Matt Egelson that actually is in Santa Barbara, and is, he has a super, very, very cool gel that is made of nanodroplets, and in which he can look at all this complicated phenomenology. Okay, so the other thing that I want to tell you is, in general, what is my program with looking at this material? So what I want to do is two things. One is to start to, because of this heterogeneity, and I think it's a good motivation to start from looking at the material with numerical simulations, and so this is what I'm going to start with, and what I want to do is to use the numerical simulation of a model system to gain some understanding of the physics that is going on in this material, the microscopic physics in these materials. So, because in fact, in many cases, to rationalize the mechanics, the idea, and to interpret, let's say, the rheological data, people use simplification as okay. At the end, this is a restructuring network, so this is a Maxwell fluid. If I wait long enough, the whole thing will restructure and will basically flow. Or, for example, to explain double yielding, well, there are some weak spots in the material. When I start to shear it, I will break this only this connection, and then I will have a fluid of cluster. And I think we will see from the simulation that we have been doing that, in fact, it can be much more complicated than that, and one needs a bit more understanding of what might be going on. So I want to use and then the reason for doing that is that hopefully then I could, once that I have these ingredients, I could connect what I have understood of the physics of the system to theories or models. For amorphous solids. Of the type that we have been discussing so far. So in fact, most of the things that we've been doing is basically in this part, so this is what I'm going to show you most. We've just started to think in this direction, and I hope that you can see some connections in what I will show you, and this is basically maybe the subject for future conversations, okay, discussions. Okay, so let me show you what is the model that we use. The idea is that, in fact, you have basically particles interacting with the sticky potential, so we have a simple attractive well. And to this, we add actually another term, which is, it's basically a three-body term, so it's limiting the angle between bonds. Okay, so if I have three particles, if I have three particles that are linked by the attractive potential, basically this term is just avoid that the angle between the bonds becomes too small. Okay, so the idea to introduce this term is that in fact you need some local rigidity to support the network. And this is supported by a number of different observations. For example, these are measurements done on a chain of just of these sticky collets, where they could use optical tweezers to deform the chain, to pull the chain, and to see that it's actually able to support a finite torque. There are other indications, for example, the networks. I think that the observation is mainly that the network is an open structure, it is mechanically stable, and so it must be locally rigid in order to support its own weight. Okay?
So when you write a free body term like that, do you necessarily have to select preferred angles, or? I mean, are you putting in?
We're putting in an angle, but it's it's there is a certain arbitrarity in this choice. I mean, it's just the minimum that.
That looks like it prefers 180 degrees. The picture on the right.
Yeah, the thing is that there is this one.
Yeah.
So you can.
Not so arbitrary. Yes.
Yeah, that's not so arbitrary. So what we do in the model is just to use a smaller angle instead, and then what we do in the model is that we actually have an additional repulsion that comes into play whenever the angle gets smaller than that. Okay, so this is, I think it's relatively general idea. Okay, so with then what we with this type of yes.
Is there a proportion sufficient to produce an effective?
No, in fact, one of the reasons why there has been a limited amount of work on the behavior of the, let's say, the mechanics of the material once the gel is formed, it's because when you use in simulation, let's say that in the simulation you want to understand the system, of course, with the model that is as simple as possible and contains just the right amount of physics of the system. So typically what you would use is just a simple well of the type that we have here. And then when you enter this region, you will have a phase separation. And so you will have formation of compact droplets. And this will basically be always the dominating phenomenon that you will see in the simulations. So the courses, so you will have, for example, if you quench your system at a finite concentration low enough below the coexistence curve, you can get a ramified structure, but this will coarsen relatively fast. And in the simulation, you will mainly look at this. You will be able mainly to look at this coarsening.
So you're saying that these tenuous structures are not because a particle wouldn't be happy to have more neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's because the neighbors somehow don't want to be near one another. It's a three-body term rather than a rather than a natural polymer kind of thing where everyone wants only two neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's
in the polymers there is a chemical balance, right, of the monomers. Here this is not the case.
You can reduce clustering by changing the range of the attraction.
Yes, you can, but not enough. At least, so one thing is it could be that in the experiments you have a solvent, right, and then you have polydispersity, and so then and you have probably you might have other complicated things, and so then it could be that the coarsening dynamics, for example, the kinetics is much, much slower with respect to your observation window, and so you are able actually to see the effects of the dynamics of the gel. In the simulation, unless you don't want to, you tend to avoid including explicitly the solvent. And then you can have, typically, if you use just this part of the potential, you will not be able to study really the gel alone without this, the evolution that it's driven by the thermodynamics.
So do you have some reason to believe that at the microscopic level what's going on is more like what you have written here, which is an angle-dependent potential, rather than something more dynamical, whereas like if two particles come into contact, then they cannot rotate. Like I can imagine that, like some kind of high Coulombic friction.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that kind of effect also giving you this.
Yes.
So why do you prefer one over the other?
For the moment, I think this is a nice. It's a simple way to include this effect and to give me the possibility to study the dynamics of the network as such and the mechanics of the network as such without worrying about the other evolution, the rest of the time evolution. This type of phenomena can be important, for example, in certain systems, let's say in many cases, for example, the colloidal particles are covered with polymer to statically stabilize them, and so then you can imagine that if the potential, the interaction is very short range, then you have some kind of overlap of the polymers, and this might lead to limiting the rotational angle. Another point is that, for example, in protein gels, which probably are the most similar to this situation, what happens is that when the gel forms, the particle, let's say, they sinter a bit. So there is really a rigidity, a local rigidity of the bond that arises, and this is probably most similar to what we have here.
But you're using, in this diagram, you're saying that the attractive interaction is not so strong as to stick permanently and then not be able to move because KT over U is...
It's non-zero. So what I'm saying is that it's non-zero. So it means that there you can see some effect of KT when
you can break.
They can be broken.
You can move or break and reattach at different angles if you want it.
Yes.
So it's not like DLA where everything
exactly.
gets tenuous because it's stuck that way.
Exactly. And so when I'm especially I'm interested to consider this aspect because even when attraction strengths are very important, then you can imagine that once that you, for example, start to deform the material, then the fact that you have internal dynamics can be very important. Okay.
Well, just another remark.
No, sure.
Wouldn't it be simpler to maybe put a slight amount of long-range repulsion in your potential in your two-body?
Typically, with the long-range repulsion, you have also this will limit will change a bit the scenario, but in many cases, I mean, depends on the amount of repulsion that you put, and typically, you start a different type of phase diagram in which you have microphase separation, and you can have a gel that forms out of this modulated structure, which is, if you want, so we've done also something like that. It's interesting, and it's also what is observed actually in a number of experimental systems when the particle have a small residual charge on the, so there is a small, actually, in a number of collided systems, there is a small residual, a long range, small repulsion. The point for using this model is because, in fact, the gel that we get, it's very simple in the structure. Okay, so I would argue that this is nice because it is the simplest, the lowest level of complication that I need to get a structure that I can handle in the simulation, that I can study looking at the dynamics and trying to deform the material, and that in which it's easy to then to make the connection between the mechanics that I will see and the features of the structure. So that's why this is we've started to do this with that. And
you would get something without the free body term, right? You just think it wouldn't be realistic.
I think probably in these protein jets where the particles are really, the bond is really locally rigid, yes, probably it's realistic. I will show you. It's not, I think it's realistic for a number of systems. Not for all systems, because of course, as I said, pretty much everything is there, so you can imagine a different type of situation. But again, for example, I can think that my particles are really the collider particles, right? Or are some lumps of this network, right? So here, this network is formed of particles, and then you can see that the particles, they form lumps, and then the lumps are aggregated in the network. And so you can imagine that the connection between the lumps are actually made of many particles, and this gives some local rigidity to the structure. And this is what I'm trying to capture in this way. Okay? Okay, so what you get is that with this type of effective interaction is that you can study the network, this network of particles at relatively small volume fraction. What I'm going to show you, I think it's mainly around 10%. And so what we do is that we have the particles in the simulation box, we switch on the interaction, and then the particles self-assemble in this type of structure. Here, this is the same type of structures that I have here. I'm just using a bond representation to simplify. And as I said, for this volume fraction that I'm going to show you today, it's mainly chains with so particles that are connected, that are coordinated 2 and 3. Okay, and the interest is to have a structure that is relatively stable, and I can study the deformation of the system in presence of the same form, the same forces that have actually made it mechanically stable. So this is what is interesting. Okay, so what we have done here is that we have a bond representation of the network, and we have color-coded it with the quantity that it's the local density of nodes. So you sit on a particle, you look in a sphere of a certain radius, and you count how many network nodes you have. Okay, so you can see that there are some parts of the network that are red, right? So which are part of the, these are parts of the network that are relatively densely connected. And then there are blue parts that are really blue, and these are really the looser parts of the network. So I think that I want to make the point that this structural heterogeneity and this, it's important for the
red regions, what's a node? Can you point to a node?
A node is, for example, this.
And there are 18 nodes near that red guy, and
yes,
none near the blue ones?
Yes. So this is the density, right? And, oh no, this is just a number, sorry. But basically you count within a sphere over a certain distance.
I'm just looking at that, yeah. And I don't see that they look very different.
I guess you have to believe me. And it's,
okay.
And it's just, it's just that it's a 3D image. And let me see if I can run. But you will see the...
And of course this number changes with the threshold of the range.
Of course, yes. But the point is just to show that there are... Because
is there a natural radio that you can pick because there's an interaction?
So this radius, what we use, the point here in what we have seen in both the dynamics and in the mechanics is that, in fact, it's really some environment of a bond that actually affect the way that bonds will behave. And so then, this size of this region is certainly larger than one bond. Okay, so it's larger than our interaction range.
About how much larger?
Probably, I mean, there is a natural length scale in this that is, if you want, you can define a mesh size of the network, like, and this is around 5-6 particles at this length.
Somehow it should depend on the distance to the Bayer transition, or, I mean, this...
Yes, so in the sense that if you go down in volume fraction, it's totally like that, so if you go down in volume fraction, basically you will tend to increase the mesh size of the network, and so you will have, you will increase, you know, the influence region in the local environments, but probably also the correlation will be lower, so...
So the size of the sphere you picked to define this quantity here is
I think it's five particle diameter.
So it's just this mesh size.
Yes, it's, from the dynamics we know that there is something changing qualitatively if you look at, distances that are small with of the order of the particle diameter or are beyond the mesh size of the node. So we really see a change in the dynamics if we look at this. So the change that we see in the dynamics, this is, we compute just one of the possible quantities, this intermediate scattering function, that is basically measuring the correlation in the particle displacement, the time correlation in the particle displacement. And so then the symbols here, this is what you would get for actually a wave vector that corresponds to distances of the Okay, so the what is here, I'm actually plotting a wave vector that is corresponds to distances of the order of the mesh size of the network, okay? And the symbols here is just this intermediate scattering function for the network that I have shown you, that is at finite temperature, so as the time lapses, it can rearrange and restructure, okay? Then we do another thing. We say we take exactly the same network, and we freeze the bonds, okay? And then we let it evolve at finite temperature without bonds breaking, okay? And this is what you measure, okay? So this is basically measuring the vibration of the network without any bond breaking. And the other thing that we measured is the fluctuations in this average dynamics, which is this type of chi-4 function, okay? And so what you see that measured the amount of cooperativity that you have in these correlations. And so you can see that, again, this one, this dashed line here, is the signal that we get from the frozen network, okay? Whereas this peak that we see, it was we get from the restructuring network. So this tells you that although the restructuring, what I was saying before, basically that although the restructuring is basically the process initiated by breaking a bond in this case only by thermal, mainly by thermal fluctuations. In fact, the restructuring is a cooperative process that involves probably larger parts of the network. Okay.
Have you happened to measure the non-Gaussian parameter?
Yes.
Do you remember what it is?
The height?
How big it is?
I don't remember, honestly, but I can
remember. But so this is all quiescent, right?
Yes,
not
at rest.
But in principle, it's aging too, right?
So what we did and we can do with this model is that we can start from a configuration that it's very obtained by very slow cooling, exactly because we can postpone and delay the phase separation as much as possible, and so it means that this structure this state is very reproducible and there is hardly any aging that we can detect. Then we can play with quenching and get more aging, but. Okay, so what I'm going to do what we did is try to investigate the spatial resolution of these processes, these cooperative processes that are associated with the restructuring, and try to understand where do they come from and how we can recognize them in the structure. So what we did is this isoconfigurational analysis that Jörg was mentioning also on Monday. So you start from the same particle configuration, you create copies of your system with different distribution of velocities, and then you let them evolve, each of them with molecular dynamics. What is interesting in doing this is that then you can get this sample of states that you have at a time scale that you think it's interesting. In particular, here it's going to be the time at which we have a peak in the Chi4, and then you can measure basically, for example, the tendency of a single particle to have a significant structural rearrangement over this time scale, and we can measure the tendency of each bond to break. Okay. So this is just a slightly more complicated version because you have to filter out, the vibration of the network to, otherwise you don't see much. And so what you get is this. No, it's working. So here, this is the same network and the same color code that I used before. It's just that I'm the thickness of the strands is actually proportional to the tendency of each bond to break. Okay? So you can see that you have these thicker parts that tend to be actually red. Okay? Which tells you that the network will tend to break in the parts that are more densely connected.
But so are you normalizing by the number of connections that are there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is
basically measuring the correlation between the bonds that are broken and this local density of nodes. Okay. So you, for example, you have nodes that part of nodes that actually don't break much, and it really depends on the environment around them and how the network is densely connected around them. And you can convince yourself that this is makes sense because if you look at local stresses, for example, you can recognize that these are the parts where tensile stresses tend to accumulate. Okay. So then you can ask the question, okay, if the network is breaking in these red points, where is actually the subsequent structural rearrangement happening? Okay. And this is what you get. So this is the tendency of structural rearrangement to happen after breaking. And so you can see that now, this is now the thickness of my network. And so you can see that you have these blue sausages, okay?
So the structural rearrangement again was not bond breaking, it was motion? Or?
It's the displacement. So the idea is that this is how the network rearranges.
And this is the non-local, non-affine displacement or something?
It is very correlated to that. This is just by looking at where major structure arrangement has happened in terms of displacement of particles.
But if the whole region rotates, you would still make it this includes rotations, or it's removed rotations?
It includes it, but for example, we can compute non-affine displacement, and you see that this is strongly correlated to that. Okay. So the point of this is to show that, in fact, the dynamical processes one should think about are actually a bit more complicated than what the examples I was mentioning before, in the sense that whenever some breaking occurs, in fact, the consequences are can be are happening and are extended in far away in the network structure. Okay. So now what we did is that we deform this type of system. And what we have done is, for the moment, having seen that the dynamical processes at finite temperature are already fairly complicated, is to consider a deformation at zero temperature. Okay, so which allows us basically to study only the effect of the deformation on the mechanics of the network. Okay, so what we do is that we apply a small, we do the deformation in this way, we apply a small strain to the affinely to the whole structure, and then we run a molecular dynamic evolution of the system using these damped dynamics. Okay, and so you can iterate this type of process as much as you want to compute the behavior of material at different level of accumulated strain. It's basically very similar to AQS, but we don't minimize completely the energy of the system. We use this type of dynamics, as I said, and the thing is that now I can vary this step to change the rate of my deformation. Mm. Okay. So depending on that choice, I can go to a lower minimum if you want, and therefore I can change the rate in my simulation. So I can actually identify, you know, I can think in terms of what is happening is that there is a characteristic time scale in this type of process, which is basically the you know, the time, the characteristic time for a particle to move in a solvent of this friction, and when it's linked to the network structure by this type of energy. And these are, what I'm going to show you is three, and then compute the shear rate in terms of this time, characteristic time, and these are three shear rates that I'm going to investigate. I can put, you know, I can try to estimate putting real numbers in this time scale for a typical colloidal system in an aqueous suspension, and these are the shear rates that I will get. Okay? Just to have an idea of where I am in the experiment. So as I deform the system, I can compute stresses, and I will get this load curve for the material. Okay? And this is for different shear rates. Okay? So one thing, this is a zoom in this elastic region, which is a bit lower than 10% in strain. And here it's the response is relatively independent on the rate. Okay? And so what you see, yes, is that there is this relatively strong nonlinear part. And then there is, in this part, it's basically independent on the rate, and then you have that the yielding part is instead strongly dependent on the rate. So one thing that we did here is to compute the contributions to the stress of the different parts of the potential, the two-body part and the three-body part. Okay. So this dashed red line is the two-body part, and this green is the three-body part. So you can see that in the linear regime, they are more or less comparable in magnitude, although they are opposite in direction. So it tells you that, in fact, whereas the two-body part is basically opposing the deformation, the three-body part is a bit pushing in the sense of the deformation. And this is consistent of the fact that in this initial configuration, the network is relatively under compression. The chains are a bit bent, and so when you start to pull on it, it will favor the extension, okay? And then when you enter in this nonlinear regime, basically you can see that everything is dominated by this two body part of the potential, and so you're basically stretching on the bonds, okay? So you can test actually this idea by measuring the angle between bonds along the chains. And this is the histogram of these angles and how it changes as you increase the accumulated strain. And so you see that you have this, this is the initial one, and then it moves towards, as you enter in this linear regime, in this nonlinear regime, you actually start to see this peak, so you are basically stretching the chains completely, okay? And so then you can actually look to what happens in the material under deformation. So this is again my network, but what I'm plotting here as thickness of the bond is basically the largest positive eigenvalue of the stress tensor. And so then you can see that this nonlinear regime, yeah, this is what it's happening, that I'm actually pulling on this part of the network, where you see the blue is where it's going to break. And but also, this is in this range of the load curve. And but also what you can recognize is that this process is initiated by a very strong stress localization. So at the beginning, really, it's because the stress is concentrating in, and actually even at the end, it's concentrated in a relatively small part of the structure. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you can go beyond start to look into this yielding part. For example, an interesting observation is to look at how many bonds the stress had broken, the deformation has broken or had reforming, okay? And so this is the fraction of broken bonds. So you can see that basically until here, there is hardly any bond broken. And then what is interesting, this is the fraction, okay? So I don't know where you want to put the yielding point. Let's say this is in the peak, but wherever you put it, actually the fraction of bonds that you need to break to initiate the yielding of the material is very small, actually. Okay. And then you can see that if you look at the fraction of bonds that have been broken, this is that have been formed. This is this blue symbol. And the dashed line is the same quantity at higher shear rates, okay? So what is a bit strange here, if you notice, is that once the system starts to yield, at that time when this figure was made, we were not actually sure that there, here, you get to some steady state. Okay, now we have a bit more indication that this is the case. But in any case, what's interesting is that here, I'm in this yielding part of the network. And in fact, if I increase the shear rate, I'm actually able to support higher stresses, right? But if I count how many bonds have been formed under deformation, it's actually less, okay? So this is a bit counterintuitive. And so this suggests that actually the bonds that have been formed, they are not necessarily contributing to supporting the stresses or to the rigidity of the material. So this suggests that there has been, that as you lower the rate, there is some maybe significant structural reorganization of the network that is going on. So what we did is to look at the local density. So we divide the system in boxes and we look at the density in each of these boxes. These are these histograms. And here in this direction, you decrease the shear rate, okay? And so you see that as you decrease the shear rate, you start to see a part of the system from which actually particles are kind of depleted, so there is an interface that is being created or a damage. Or and so what you can do is that you can compute you can divide your system in slices and compute in the shear plane and compute the displacement, the average displacement in each of these slices. Okay. And this is plotted here as a function of the y coordinate of the slide. And so this is a kind of velocity profile, right? It's the average displacement. I can just divide by my time interval and get a velocity profile. And so at high shear rate, this is fairly, it's linear. And this quantity here is the value of the density in the slide. And as I decrease the shear rate, I can see that the velocity profile gets banded. And this is where I start to have this hole or interface in my system. Okay. And I'm basically done. This is what I wanted to show. This is the basically just a projection on a plane of the velocity profile that you would see. And maybe I will stop here and leave time for questions. And these are references where there is most of this work. If you already have a setup,
my computer's plugged in.
So. Oh, sorry, please. Yes, okay. Yes.
So maybe one or two questions. If not, she's here. Then I would say, since we were running late.
I mean, so I'm just thinking that if you really think it's necessary to have the bond bending rule to get the same qualitative behavior like that you showed us with the, you know, the formation of defects where you have low density and a persistent shear bend.
No, I don't think. I don't think this is the case. I think that if you're able to have in your simulation the network that is obtained, for example, by arrested phase separation, mm-hmm. and that is persistent enough to study the network dynamics and where the aging or the coarsening is happening slow enough, I would guess that you would see the same thing. But it's just that this is objectively difficult in simulation because you need to have enough attraction so to keep the thing together, but still something happening. So you don't want to zero temperature. You don't want to go to zero temperature because nothing will move. And
if you form the particular network with mm-hmm. the free body term on, mm-hmm. and then you put it into shear with the free body term off, do you mm-hmm. think things would change at all?
I think it will start to coarsen locally.
Wouldn't it just make a fluid?
Yeah. I think you will just melt it because anyway the particle one with the bond that can be formed, they will be formed with a compact they will tend to form compact droplets.
It'll rapidly.
You still have a chain.
You,
right?
Start,
you might
not have
any.
That's the deformation.
That's not stable. The chain will form little droplets and course them. Surely. If I start letting Jones particles in a long fibrous network and I let them go, they'll all zip in.
So that's why this one say you need to do this the deformation under the same forces that make the network stable.
You don't think?
Look at the glass slide.
Mm-hmm. Then it'll form a crystal.
Yeah. I guess what. The color map is what?
Is the amount of displacement.
I see. And so there is a kind of
there is a bend.
Right. And the width of that mm-hmm. bend goes from being extremely sharp.
This is linear. This is in the case in which the velocity profile is linear.
Oh, it's absolutely
right?
linear.
It's absolutely linear. And instead here you could define a region where actually the displacement.
And you go from one to the other by
increasing. When this is in the linear and non-linear regime, mm-hmm. and this is when you start the yielding
mm-hmm.
and sufficiently long shear rate.
And do you understand how that width increases as you change gamma? I mean,
we haven't. We're just starting to look into that. This is one of the interesting things. One thing that we see clearly is that you don't see the bending if you don't go to a large enough system. So here I've shown you simulations that have been done on 500,000 particles.
Mm.
And if you don't go to a very big system, you don't necessarily see the stability.
You don't see the bend.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't go straight up.
Is it because when you're small, you're looking inside?
Or maybe there is a size.
Mm.
All right, well, let's thank her again for a great talk.